being an oldest child, we tend to have this need, we'll call it a need, to keep the younger siblings in their place because they like to get full of themselves and see how much they can take, how much you can take. And by cheat or whatever manner, which is all I have left at these days, thank goodness neither one of my siblings are here to admit that, but you have to keep them in your place. You feel that need as you're growing up, a constant competitiveness we'll go with. But it's always whenever they've done something really good or whenever you've done something really good that you tend to get full of yourself. It's human nature. And you find your way off the high, we'll call it that. I was looking at examples in the Bible of this earlier. I noticed we follow a trend. I'll start off looking at Moses as an example. And we follow this nice, lovely trend, it seems like. And Moses, as we all know, was born in Egypt when he should have died right away. I mean, had he been any other child or God not intervened, he'd been dead. But he was saved, and saved and raised in the palace. So he had the greatest education that the world could offer at that point in time, arguably. So God, right off the bat, had set Moses up for success. But after that, he ran away, and then God comes to him. Okay, you know, I set you up. Now's when I need you. You're going to come rescue all these people. All these people. And what was Moses' words? No. Exodus 3, when we have his rebuttal there, he's at the burning bush. And God tells Moses, verse 10, "Come now, therefore, and I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt." And Moses' answer isn't, "Well, I was raised in the palace, and I know all this stuff, so yeah, I can go back to Egypt. That's no big deal." What's verse 11? "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh, and that I should bring the children of Israel out of Egypt?" So even then, Moses was like, "Well, are you sure I'm the one you want?" But yet, God gave Moses proof. He had to convince him to go. Right there in that same chapter, he gives him, I guess it's the next chapter, but he gives him three miracles that he can perform. He could throw his stick down and turn into a snake at that point in time. Grab it by the tail, pick it back up, it's a stick again. He could stick his hand into his coat, into his shirt and pull it out, and it was leprous, and back out again. And the third one, if nobody would believe him, this is what God told him would make the Israelites believe him. Forget the Egyptians. He said, "Well, take some water from the river, a cup, just dump it on the shore, and there'll be blood when it hits the ground." And that was just so the Israelites would believe him. So God convinced him he had the ability to do it. And still, he's like, "Well, I can't talk. I stutter. I'm sure I can come up with something else I can't do." And he goes, "Fine. You have a brother. Your brother can talk well. So, and he's coming out to meet you." So he convinced him, "Okay, I'm not going by myself." God gave Moses the support system he was going to need. He didn't put him in charge and leave him up by himself. And then after he got everybody out of Egypt, Moses is still on that way upward trail. He's still on the right path. The glory still goes to God. And Numbers 16, this is right after, or right in the middle of Korah's rebellion. And Moses said in verse 28, after these people had stood up and said, "Well, why are you taking all this?" And Moses said, "Well, by this you shall know that the Lord sent me to do all this work, for I have not done them of my own will." So Moses admitted, nothing of this was my idea. This was all God put me in place. God put me in this. If all the men who stood against him died naturally, then okay, everything he said was a lie. But instead, the earth opened its mouth, it says, and swallowed them all under the end and closed back on them. So he continued giving God the glory. But what was Moses' downfall? And I'm really starting to get used to this at work now. He got frustrated. That's what happened. Moses got frustrated. This isn't the first time that Moses had to get water out of a rock. And yes, the first time Moses was told to hit the rock with the stick. The first rock he was told to strike with a stick and it would give water. But it was the second one, and that's only a couple chapters over in Numbers 20. I think. And Moses was told to ask the rock for water. And by asking the rock, it was guaranteed that Moses was not going to take any credit for, wasn't going to be able to take credit for asking the rock for water. If I go out and talk to the gravel, it's not going to give me much at all. But instead, Moses, out of frustration, verse 10, and Moses and Aaron gathered the assembly together before the rock, and he said to them, "Hear now, you rebels, must we bring water for you out of this rock?" Then Moses lifted his hand and struck the rock twice with his rod, and water came out abundantly, and the congregation and their animals drank. Then the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, "Because you did not believe me to hallow me in the eyes of the children of Israel, therefore you shall not bring this assembly into the land which I have given them." So one bit of acting out and frustration took it on himself and said, "Why should I give you the water? Why have you come to me for this?" And it cost him going into Canaan. But yet reading on, he continues to serve the Lord all the way till death. He doesn't pout and, what's the point now? He doesn't die until December. Wow. Let's go with Deuteronomy instead. Then to Deuteronomy chapter 34. That's close to the end. And I like verse 10. It says, "But since there has not been arisen in Israel a prophet like Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face." Whenever you think of the prophets of Israel, Moses isn't generally one that pops in your head right away. But yet the Bible tells us he's the only one that met God face to face. We have to remember that God gives us all things. Genesis 9:3 is when Noah was told that he can eat everything after the flood. The only restriction is you don't eat the meat with the blood still in it. Sorry, Greg. Then Philippians 4:13 says, "I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me." So we can know we can do everything through God. Like looking at another Old Testament example, the example of Gideon, that's in Judges chapter 6. And you'll start to see it follows a very similar path here. Starting in verse 15, this is right after the angel of the Lord has told Gideon that you're going to deliver Israel from the Midianites. His answer was, "Oh my Lord, how can I serve Israel? Indeed, my clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I am the least in my father's house." I'm not sure. Can you not please find somebody better? Defense. And God did the same thing. He spent the next chapter convincing him that he can do it. First with the fleece. If you put the fleece down and make the the water, was the fleece wet the first time and the ground dry? And then, but then he reversed it the other way. Which one comes first? I'm not sure. But I'm not sure I would have the gumption, for lack of a better term, look at God after the first time I'd ask him. And it turned out that, right, well, you sure you can't do it the other way just to make sure I'm right? But Gideon needed all the confidence he could get. Not only those two, right before the battle, Gideon's seen his 32,000 dwindle down to 300 people. And in the next chapter, chapter 7, God has to prod him to take his servant over to the Midianite camp and listen in on the eavesdrop on them. And he listened to the Midianite's dream in verse, starting in verse 9. It happened on the same night that the Lord said to him, "Arise, go down against the camp, for I have delivered it into your hand. But if you are afraid to go down to the camp with Pura, your servant, and you shall hear what they say, and afterward your hands shall be strengthened to go down against the camp." Then he went down with Pura, his servant, to the outpost of the armed men who were in the camp. Now the Midianites and the Amalekites, all the people of the east, were lying in the valley, as numerous as locusts, and their camels were without number, as the sand by the seashore in multitude. And when Gideon had come, there was a man telling a dream to his companion. He said, "I have had a dream. To my surprise, a loaf of barley bread tumbled into the camp of Midian, and it came to a tent and struck it so that it fell and overturned, and the tent collapsed." Then his companion answered and said, "This is nothing else but the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, a man of Israel. Into his hand, God has delivered Midian and the whole camp." It's amazing, but the enemies of Gideon were more convinced of Gideon's what was going to happen than Gideon was. It wasn't until that point. That next verse, verse 15, "When Gideon heard the telling of the dream and its interpretation that he worshipped, he returned to the camp of Israel and said, 'Arise, for the Lord has delivered the camp of Midian into your hand.'" So that was the point where he went, okay, maybe this will happen because God said it will happen. So he gets the credit for that. In fact, in the next chapter, chapter 8, this is after he's chased down all the princes of Midian. In verse 22, "The men of Israel said to Gideon, 'Rule over us, both you and your son, and your grandson also, for you have delivered us from the hand of Midian.' But Gideon said to them, 'I will not rule over you, nor shall my son rule over you. The Lord shall rule over you.'" Gideon was still humble. He knew who had won the battle for them. So it looks like Gideon's off scot-free, right? No, in that next verse, "I would like to make a request of you that each of you would give me the earrings from his plunder." For they had golden earrings because they were Ishmaelites. So they gave all the golden earrings as plunder to Midian. And he took in verse 27 and he made it into an ephod and set it up in his city, Ophrah. And all of Israel played the harlot with it there. It became a snare to Gideon and to his house. I don't remember God telling him to take the plunder and make it into something to remember this by. So all of that, this is the same person that beforehand destroyed his father's idols as his first act that God had given him. But he ended up setting up his own idol. Another person we often look at in the Old Testament is Saul. Starting in 1 Samuel chapter 9, he's probably the poster boy, for lack of a better term, for the person who grew very quickly into their head got too big too quickly. Starting in verse 21, this is 9:21. Samuel had just told him, you know, that he is the desire of Israel. That is on him and all his father's house at the end of 20. And Saul answered and said, "Am I not a Benjamite of the smallest of the tribes of Israel? And my family the least of all the families of the tribe of Benjamin? Why then do you speak like this to me?" Now this is a man who stood head and shoulders above everybody else in the nation. They said when he gathered together, it was well obvious who he was. Nobody else stood the same height as him. But yet he was, "Are you sure it was me that you want for this?" And when they came to, when it finally came time to name a king, in 1 Samuel 10, where did they find Saul with the rest of his family? No, verse 21, they sought him but could not be found. He was hiding in the equipment. This is after he's already been told that he's going to be in charge and be the first one. He didn't even appear before God. He was hiding in the equipment. In 23, so they ran and brought him from there. And when he stood among the people, he was taller than any of the people from his shoulders up. So he's very humble. He doesn't believe he should be in this spot. But he also gets convincing also, and that's, I kind of skipped over that in the middle there. That would be verses 9 through 11. Of the same chapter, Samuel told him, "Look, you're going to come up to a hill. There's going to be prophets playing tambourines and other musical instruments and prophesying. And when you meet them, you will begin prophesying too." And sure enough, he met them, and he was prophesying enough that in 10 verse 12, there was a man there, and, oh, I'm sorry, verse 11. That the people said to one another, "What is this that has come upon the son of Kish? Is Saul also among the prophets?" They had nobody who knew him. It was as if he became a different man. So he had been convinced also. Or he had to be convinced also. And we've all heard of Saul's demise. That's in verse 13, or chapter 13, is when he goes and he offers a sacrifice to the Lord because Samuel didn't come at the exact moment that Saul thought he should have. Sorry, in verse 8, "Then Saul waited 7 days according to the time set by Samuel. But Samuel did not come to Gilgal, and the people were scattered from him. So Saul said, 'Bring a burnt offering and peace offerings here to me.' And he offered the burnt offering. Now it happened as soon as he had finished presenting the burnt offering that Samuel came, and Saul went out to meet him, that he might greet him." So not only did Saul not realize what he'd done, but he was happy to see Samuel. So just because it was Saul who offered instead of Samuel is the first part of, anyway, and then in chapter 15, when they kept the king and all the good stuff of the Amalekites alive, they were told to utterly destroy absolutely everything, nothing, don't bring anything back from the Amalekites. And 1 Samuel 15:9 says, "But Saul and the people spared Agag and the best of the sheep, the oxen, the fatlings, the lamb, and all that was good, and were unwilling to utterly destroy them. But everything despised and worthless, that they utterly destroyed." So he didn't follow the exact word of what he should have. He was told to destroy everything, but he only destroyed that which had no value. I looked at a New Testament example. And I was looking at Peter, and Peter also was set up for success. God made sure he had 3 years with Jesus. After 3 years with Jesus, he should have been able to walk. You know, at least we, looking back on him, since we didn't have the 3 years, we look at, said he should have been able right there with Jesus to not have the problems they did. He had seen the miracles of Jesus calming the sea. he'd seen the feeding of 5,000 with five loaves and two fish. And I've filleted a lot of fish, but I've never filleted them in that small of pieces. But he's seen Jesus walking on the water. And yes, Peter hopped out of the boat as soon as Jesus said, "Come to me." All right. If you can do it, I can do it since you're here. Till he looked away from Jesus. But Peter was good when Jesus was around. He can do anything with him. The Matthew 14 and verses 30 and 31 is when he was walking on the water. The good thing Peter can show us is that as soon as things weren't going his way, he knew exactly where to turn back to. And see, in 26, "And when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were troubled, saying, 'It is a ghost,' and they cried out for fear. But immediately Jesus spoke to them, saying, 'Be of good cheer, it is I, do not be afraid.' And Peter answered him and said, 'Lord, if it is you, command me to come out to you on the water.' So he said, 'Come.' And when Peter had come down out of the boat, he walked on the water to go to Jesus. But when he saw that the wind was boisterous, he was afraid, and beginning to sink, he cried out, saying, 'Lord, save me.' And immediately Jesus stretched out his hand and caught him, and said to him, 'O you of little faith, why did you doubt?'" So we know Peter was very willing when Jesus was around. According to verse 28, he didn't even know for sure it was Jesus. He believed it was Jesus, or else I wasn't getting out of a boat in the boisterous waves. But he was good till he looked away. But he tells us that he knew to come back to the Lord afterwards. One of Peter's problems that we face a lot is peer pressure. He faced it at the end of Matthew when he denied Christ. That's Matthew 26. Starting verse 69. "Now Peter sat outside in the courtyard, and a servant girl came to him, saying, 'You also were with Jesus of Galilee.' But he denied it before them all, saying, 'I do not know what you are saying.' And when he had gone out to the gateway, another girl saw him and said to those who were there, 'This fellow also was with Jesus of Nazareth.' But again he denied with an oath, 'I do not know the man.' And a little later, those who stood by came up and said to Peter, 'Surely you also are one of them, for your speech betrays you.' Then he began to curse and swear, saying, 'I do not know the man.' Immediately a rooster crowed, and Peter remembered the word of Jesus, who had said to him, 'Before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times.' So he went out and wept bitterly." The same person who had seen all the miracles, Jesus wasn't around at that time. Jesus was facing his own trial. And now, wait, I'm by myself here, surrounded by people who are looking to lynch anybody connected with Jesus. And now I'm worried. I mean, he got to the point where he was cursing and swearing, cursing and swearing to him that he did not know the man. But as soon as he remembered it, he went out and wept bitterly. As soon as he knew what Jesus was talking about and that he had betrayed him, it cut him all the way down to where he went out and cried. Unfortunately, it's not the last time we have Peter and peer pressure together. We have the record from Paul that Peter was would eat with the Gentiles as long as the Jews weren't around. But the minute the Jews were around, then that had to stop. Couldn't quite go all the way out on the limb there. So all these people have shown us how even if we're on our way up and giving everything to all the credit to God, how how things can change quickly and we can get in our own way. As I said earlier, God gives us all things, but we have to make sure we give all things back to God. 1 Corinthians 10:31, give God the glory. All things are through Him. We also have to make sure, and this is what the hardest part is for me anyway, is making sure that I'm following God's plan, not the I think this is what God would want in the 21st century's plan. We're told in Revelations that if you add or take anything away from this book, that your name will be taken away from the book of life. I have one last scripture to go to. It's 1 John chapter 3. Starting in verse 22. And whatever we ask, we receive from Him, because we keep His commandments and do those things that are pleasing in His sight. And this is His commandment, that we should believe on the name of His Son, Jesus Christ, and love one another as He gave us commandment. Now he who keeps His commandments abides in Him, and He in him. And by this we know that He abides in us by the Spirit whom He has given us. We just have to follow the Word of God. He's told us exactly how to do it. Let's follow His commandments.